This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to the inaugural episode of The Radical Therapist, a podcast that is interested in exploring the intersections of therapy, art, philosophy, science and technology, and even we'll even dabble in some psychology here and there. So welcome to the show. Glad you're listening. I'm really excited today because I have a good friend in who is based in London here on our first episode. And when I thought about doing a first episode, she came right to mind because she does travel in many of those intersections previously described. Natasha Caruana is an artist based in London, an exciting artist. She's a photographic artist and has a MA in photography from the Royal College of Art in London, is a senior lecturer of photography at the University of Creative Arts in Surrey. And probably most something big that's happened in her life recently. In 2014, Natasha was named as the winner of the BMW Artists in Residence Award at the Musée Nicéphore Niépce in France, and that's kind of a big deal. And she created some work during that residency that's going to start traveling. It's being shown in France now, but it hopefully will find its way to Photo LA in early spring. So mark that after you hear the interview, if you get pretty curious about what she's doing. Hopefully the work will be here in LA in spring. Natasha's own art practice is grounded in research and concerned with narratives of love, betrayal, and fantasy, and we'll be talking about several projects that kind of capture those themes. Her work, Natasha's work, has been shown internationally from the United States, Poland, Germany, China, Australia, and Saudi Arabia. It's been shown a lot of different places. And recently, her work was nominated for the 2014 Foam Paul Huff Award, and she's been shortlisted by the Deutsche Bank Pyramid Prize in 2008 and for the National Magazine Awards in 2007. Natasha has been named as one to watch in the Royal Photographic Society Journal and selected by the Humble Arts Foundation as one of 18 leading female art photographers currently working in the UK. I think you're going to find her work fascinating. And without further ado, let's just get started. All right, Natasha, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
Yes. Just for our listeners, you are currently in London, correct?
Yes. Okay. It's cold, of course.
It is. It's always cold.
It's freezing.
Actually, London
is... weather warning. 40 miles per hour speed of wind right now.
I have to tell you, London is the coldest place I've ever been. And I've been to a lot of cold places. But for some reason, December in London got me to my bones.
Yeah, it's the damp. Yeah.
Well, anyway, thank you for coming to the show. It's our Radical Therapist's first show, and I'm really excited to have you as our first guest. We've known each other for several years now. We collaborated in the past. You actually had a solo show at my old exhibition space, The Office, and that was exciting. And
super exciting. And that was my first solo show, Chris Hoff.
Yes, and now you are becoming quite the art star, and I'm very happy that you took some time to talk with us. Also, we had a chance to see each other over the holidays. I was in Paris, and you were prepping for what is a show that I want to talk to you about, your At First Sight show, which was part of your 2014 BMW residency. Correct?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, the reason I wanted to chat with you is just because, you know, this show is going to be about the intersections of psychotherapy, art, philosophy, science, technology, et cetera. And I think you really work in a lot of those intersections. And I'm thinking I'm going to go back, not to your most recent show, but maybe go back a little bit and talk about some of the themes that you've taken on or include, you know, stuff that we run into in therapy a lot, like infidelity, love, love at first sight, the fairy tale of marriage, those kinds of things. But I guess I want to go back to maybe a show that got a lot of press for you or a body of work that got a lot of press for you, and I think it's still kind of going on, and that is your Married Man project. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the Married Man project is quite extraordinary now. If I, you know, I made that in 2008 and 2009, and it's still living on now. It still resonates with a lot of people. Just today, I, you know, got an email from a big Dazed and Confused Digital. They want to run it. I'm doing a talk this weekend about a book that's coming out about it. So this Married Man is actually quite an interesting body of work, which still just it enables people to open up conversations about infidelity, betrayal, and the fantasy of affairs. And essentially what the work, well, what the work is, it's interesting that this blog, your podcast is about these kind of this slippage and these intersections. And I think for this body of work, it's really about this kind of this gray area between what we imagine an affair to be and how kind of the reality of an affair. And what I did was I set myself up as a mistress, where I suppose two things happened. I kind of worked on a personal narrative and also a universal narrative to try and create this series of work. And the first thing that happened was I was in a dentist surgery. And in this dentist surgery, I was flicking through a trashy magazine, and I saw an article about a woman that she was living her life through affairs. That's the relationship she wanted to have. She didn't want the man full time. She didn't want to wash the man's socks, for example. She just wanted him part time, all the fun bits. Mm-hmm. And at the bottom of the article, there was a kind of a clip, kind of a box that gave you further information. And in that box, it said reconnect.com. And reconnect.com was a dating site where a married man, could go on and meet a mistress. And that really stuck with me, the fact that you could now, you know, the way that the internet is advancing, 2008, you know, it was a while ago now, that the impact that the internet, or the impact that technology is putting and how it can change relationships, you can log in and you can get an affair. And also, I had previously had a relationship with a married man some years previously. And it struck me that even though they were separated, I was still essentially with a married man. And the baggage that came with that, and the way this, the idea of the institution of the marriage. And I wanted to play with that idea. I was reading Sigmund Freud at the time, where he, in the Beyond the Pleasure Principle, he spoke about if you repeat something that's traumatic, it becomes pleasurable. And I thought, what would happen if I actually repeated this idea of an affair? What would happen if I essentially met up with married men night after night, and I documented it? And that the artwork really became a collision between a performance, because I was there as a mistress. They didn't know that I was an artist, so I had to perform this first date. It also became, you know, a documentary where through photography, I was actually able to give a perspective of, you know, this tabletop between myself and the man. It became like a little theater of the affair. And it gave a point of view that no one really had ever given before, because we always see on, you know, on the TV, somebody's having an affair, on the newspaper, in the headlines, somebody's having an affair. And there's always this kind of dramatized how bad it is or what it is, this fantasy. And I was actually able to show, you know, the real nitty gritty of essentially, you know, what it is there across the table. And obviously interesting power roles happened, because I was cheating on the man because he didn't know that it was an art project. And I use a fake name, a fake number, but I did say I was an artist and he did see me take photos. But he was cheating on his family. So this kind of two wrongs that met across the tabletop were very, very interesting to me. We'd have that one date and then I would walk out the door and I wouldn't contact him again. And it wasn't about the individual stories. If you imagine, they talked to me a lot. And what the most fascinating thing was in the research process of this body of work and why it became an actual series was, at the beginning, I dated three or four men to see whether it was interesting and to kind of push myself to be uncomfortable and to take on this experience. And those first dates were absolutely eye-opening, because the men, every single one of them, used that opportunity of the date. They had gone online, they were meeting a mistress, they use that opportunity to talk about their wives. And I was fascinated that I became a marriage counsellor, where it was, you know, you just wouldn't imagine that. The idea of what we have an affair to be isn't that the man would take a woman on a date and talk about their wives. But things started to come clear to me that in society today, the wives were really just talking to their children, and the man was feeling superfluous. The man was kind of out on a whim, and they weren't able to talk to their work colleagues because of this presence of, you know, this performance that a man has to be macho and take things on board. He couldn't talk to his work colleagues. Friends became mutual friends, so he couldn't tell his friends, you know, I'm having trouble with the wife at home or with the family dynamic. And I became this soundboard for them. And I thought, because of that, actually, this is revealing something very unique about relationships today and the impact of the internet and the impact of technology. And then, although it started from a personal perspective, I was actually able to just put out there this work, which became kind of fragments, gestures, court moments, you know, the moment of anticipation before something happened. And because of that, the work on the wall is very, very open. So the audience will come into the space, see these 54 images, which represent the 54 men that I dated. They are able to actually kind of connect something with themselves or with their personal history. And every time I talk about this work, in a talk situation or a lecture, someone will always, every single time, come up to me and say, you know, their dad had an affair, or they had an affair, or, you know, something personal. And it's able to actually open up those conversations for people, which I find, you know, that's an amazing power of art. That, you know, when an artist does something, you're able to, suddenly there's a way that you can talk about things. And, you know, just to finish that, I think the first time I showed that work, and I made it, you know, finished it in 2009, but I kind of waited a year and a half before I actually put the work out, because it wasn't about the stories. I didn't want to be revealing these men's identities. And, you know, so I wanted to create a comfortable distance of what I, you know, how I felt comfortable with putting this out there. Because although there's no faces, there are still hands and clothes. And I was in this gallery space. And obviously, when you're in the opening, people don't know you're the artist. And this old couple was sitting there looking at the work. And the man said to the, you know, the wife said to the man, you know, have you ever had an affair? And they were joking. And then they actually were there in the gallery being able to have a conversation that maybe they'd never actually had before. And that was just, you know, that was an incredible moment to think about art and the way, the power that art has to open up those conversations.
Right. And thank you for that, Natasha. And I've seen the body of work, and I'm wondering if you did this by design, that it does really, in my mind, kind of cut through the fantasy of affairs and kind of really presents the reality of affairs, what you described as the nitty gritty. Was that by design, or because it kind of comes off as kind of dark to me in some ways?
Well, I suppose it just became really banal. It became really everyday. And I suppose I worked a lot to think about the aesthetic of how can I actually document this. And I at first had an assistant outside the restaurant photographing us inside. Then I'd ask the waiter to take us a photo of us. And then all the waiters knew what I was doing, so I would then come back to the restaurant to take the photo of the aftermath. And none of the images really worked. They seemed too distant. So then I used a disposable camera. And that disposable camera became very important, because it meant that the men weren't, you know, they weren't threatened, because I suddenly, you know, came out with a toy camera. So they felt that, you know, which is not a real artist, which was good. So it meant I had access. And it also meant that the images do have a particular quality, as you've picked up. You know, there are, you know, there's kind of dark splotches, there's blurs. They're not kind of beautiful, pristine, like, you know, the images you get on your iPhone now, I suppose. But, you know, these were shot quite a while ago now, you know, 7 years ago, which is just incredible to think this was 7 years ago. And that darkness, you know, it does give a sense that you're seeing something that's unseen. And it does get a sense that you are, the point of view is my point of view. So when the audience is looking at the work, they become that point of view. So you really do feel like you are in that moment when you're viewing those images, because it becomes your perspective.
Yes, and I think it does have that kind of effect. I'm wondering, you referenced Freud and this idea of repeating these kinds of events, or traumatic events can become pleasurable. Did you find yourself settling into these dates and getting a little more comfortable in the process?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd be lying if I said I wasn't, if I didn't, because, I mean, towards the end, I mean, I went on 80 dates altogether, 80 dates with 54 different men. And towards the end, I was seeing a curator, heard about the series and started to work with me on it. And he said, you know, we had a deadline of an exhibition, you know, and he said, you know, we could try and maybe finish this. And I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to actually have to really dedicate some time to this. So towards the end, I was actually seeing four men a day. So I'd meet one for lunch, maybe one for afternoon tea, then a cocktail and a drink. And it did obviously become very monotonous. It was essentially the same conversation. The hardest thing was really trying to make it seem like it was my first date each time and not to be too overconfident and to remember that, you know, these men may be, the particular sites I used, it wasn't like I was a prostitute. They did want that butterflies in the tummy. They did want to be a relationship. So I had to present that to them. I had to present that it was my first time. But it did kind of just become the same conversations, I think. It did become repetitive. There was only one date that wasn't repetitive when we went to London Zoo. And that was like a fun day compared to the others.
Okay. So this same conversation, was that where you were kind of positioned as a marriage counselor again and counseling about the wife, et cetera?
Yeah. And there were kind of two distinct men. One would present themselves at the beginning that they would be, you know, unhappy in their marriage and I would become a counselor. And then other men from the very beginning, it would be very much about, you know, the desire. And then wanting to have a sexual relationship with me and then wanting to have somebody that was separate to their wives to fulfill, you know, a different area of their life. But towards the end of the date, it would come back round to them being unhappy. And, you know, the sound, because I recorded dates and the last 30 seconds, I sometimes play these in the gallery space, just in the gallery space of them saying goodbye to me. And I'll say to them, you know, what are your intentions with me? Or where do you see this going? And I kind of get a bit of a summary of, what they were trying to look for and why they were trying to look for it.
And what were you finding?
I was finding that a lot of them were very confident in the fact that it wasn't just about sex. They said they could get sex anywhere. You know, you could just go and buy. You could go and buy some thrills with a prostitute. And they wanted something that was able to, as I said, a lot of people did mention this term, the butterflies in the tummy. They wanted someone that they could have a relationship with that was mental as well as physical. And somebody that was safe away from their wives, that they knew what was happening. You know, they were consented that they were going to be married.
Oh, they all planned to stay married, but were looking for something outside of the marriage.
Yeah, they did. So, there was that belief in the institution of marriage. But quite shockingly, I mean, it was quite a lot of it was about money. You know, a relationship, that marriage became, how would they leave? How would you split the house? What would you do with the children? But still wanting something else.
Wow. Fascinating. Did you ever feel unsafe on any of your dates?
There was just one experience. I'd say there was one bad experience and one really good experience that stuck out to me in terms of the men over those 54 men. One of them, we met and he was a little bit late and he turned up to the restaurant, this pizza restaurant, and he sat down and he said, I didn't expect you to look like that. Yeah, it was me. And he said, wow, you know, we've got to go and I know what you need. You know, I know what you want. I know you don't just want to sit and talk. What's the point? Let's go. And I said, well, no. And I said, I'm not a prostitute. I'm, you know, let's we've been talking on the phone, let's have a conversation. And yeah, he was just really adamant that he just wanted to go to bed with me. So I just left. And that was the only time where I thought, and early on, actually, there was another one where I was in a car, stupidly, I got in the car with somebody and I was holding this secret sound recorder, which is it was a purse, but it had my microphone in it, kind of very handmade. I'd created it, you know, it wasn't some high specs spy equipment. And he said, can I see that? And he grabs my purse to look at it. And he was actually just looking at the photo that was in the wallet, a little see-through wallet at the front. And my heart just stopped because he was essentially holding my purse, which had the sound recorder in it. And I was in his car. And I just thought, I need to think about how I can do this safely. But it was good. It happened straight away. And I just changed, you know, then I thought, right, I'm just going to do one date. And that's my process.
Now, you said there was a really great experience.
Yeah, one was really fun. He was an architect, so we had lots to talk about. I mean, I absolutely love architecture. It's really fascinating to me. But I didn't study it. I studied photography. So we really found a meeting of minds in conversation and culture and art, architecture. And then he said, let's go to London Zoo. So I thought, well, that's brilliant, because by then I was getting really bored with meeting for coffee or cocktails.
Right.
So we had this great day out. It was freezing cold, but it was really good fun. And then just as we were leaving, I realized I'd had such a good time that I'd forgotten to put the sound recorder on. So that really kind of proved it was just a fun day. So then I quickly went to the toilet and turned the sound recorder on and then said goodbye to him. And he's one of the only men that I thought, actually, I don't want to use the sound of that. And in terms of kind of meeting them, there was only one man that tried to kiss me. Everybody else, because it was only one date, you could kind of just say goodbye in part, and there wouldn't be too much investment by either party.
Were you struck by, was it loneliness that most of these men were experiencing, or how would you describe it?
I would say it is 90% loneliness. And 10%, yeah, but I wonder whether 10% is them just trying, was the men just trying to, I'd say 10% was them, you know, there was one website which was quite expensive. The men were paying £250 a month. I'm not sure what that is in dollars. And they were paying that to be on the site. So they wanted something in return. And these men were city bankers, you know, earning a lot of money, investment bankers. And for them, I did feel that maybe they just wanted that, you know, the trophy of having a mistress. But then if I'd met them two or three times, I would have worked out that that's only loneliness. It's incredible that so on that particular site, the expensive one, the men lived in the city Monday to Friday, and then they'd go home to the country to their wives and children on the weekend. So that there must be loneliness if you imagine you're away from your family. And just going back for the weekend, I mean, it would be a funny existence, I feel. And you wouldn't feel connected in that family dynamic.
Sure. Now, this project has gotten a lot of press. It's been shown, I imagine, in London, correct? And I'm wondering if any of these men have approached you since the project.
No one's ever approached me. And no one's ever approached me at all. I mean, it's incredible to think how much work went into each date. I talk to them online, then I might talk to them on the phone, and then I'd meet up with them. If you imagine I did that for 54 different men, it was quite labor intensive.
Right.
And they'd also say their name was Ian online. Then when we spoke, they'd say, oh, my name's actually John. And then when I met up with them face to face, I'd say, my name's Mark. So it was quite labor intensive to remember all their names. And you would imagine that over that, well, I suppose London's a big place, but there's only one that I bumped into at the time. I bumped into him whilst I was still seeing other men. I bumped into him for a second time on the tube. And we said, wow, okay, let's go for another drink. But that's the only time that I've ever bumped into one. And oh, I've just remembered another story, actually. I did bump into one at the theatre.
Okay.
He sat two rows away from me with his wife.
Oh, wow.
So I left halfway through because I thought, I don't want to.
Did he recognize you, do you think?
No, he didn't see me.
Oh,
he
okay.
But yeah, I mean, only those two experiences.
So
no one's ever contacted me afterwards.
Yeah, and this might be a good time to transition into the next project. And I'm struck by this idea of, you know, the seeking the what you described as butterflies in the tummy. But you moved, but the following project was Fairy Tale for Sale, mm-hmm. where you kind of explore wedding customs and the fantasy and performance and trophy moments of the traditional. And here in the States, it's I'm sure equally as prominent, but I'm interested in that project, how the transition went into that project, I suppose.
Yeah, so again, I suppose just like any other of my series, it started by accident, or I became intrigued by something, or I suddenly saw something. And this project started by I was on the internet. I was using a site called Gumtree. I don't know if you have Gumtree. It's a bit like Craigslist. You know, you don't pay for it. It's not eBay, but it's something like eBay, but you don't pay the fees. So community based. Mm. And I was selling something, and on the bottom, it gives you recommendations of, you might also like this. And I was looking at this item, and at the bottom, there was an advert. And the advert said, Hollywood Princess Bride. And then the image was a butchered, barbaric photo of this somebody in a wedding dress. And I thought this was a really strange juxtaposition between the language that was being used to describe the advert and the image being this aggressive photograph that had been scrapped away. And so I clicked and I saw it was somebody selling the wedding dress. And then I did a search on wedding dress and I saw that this was common practice, that women were selling their wedding dresses online. They were using their wedding day photos, the image that would be on their mantelpiece, the image that was, you know, the pinnacle image of the day, but they were masking their faces. And I started to drag these images across onto my desktop thinking, this is strange. You know, almost like it was a little bit of fun kind of collecting these little off weird images.
Right.
And then I was just continued thinking about it and thought, why are these women doing it? What does this mean? What happens to that? The image that we recognize, what happens when you mask the face? And then I thought, okay, I want to actually use these photographs, but the images weren't big enough. The images had been squished by the website to, you know, under 1 meg. So I couldn't really do anything with them. So I started to contact them when I saw them saying, I'm an artist. Why are you selling your dress? No one got back to me.
Really?
So nobody. It was just kind of, don't waste my time, or no time wasters, please. Or, you know, I didn't get anywhere. So then I set myself up as a bride. So I used that performative tactic again, like I did with the married man. And suddenly when I was a bride contacting them for their dress, I was in the club. It's like the gates had opened. Oh, it's going to be the best day of your life. Oh, you need to wear my dress. This is so incredible. Congratulations. And suddenly they were giving me stories of their wedding day, of how perfect it was. And then I was able to say to them, please, could you send me a higher resolution of the images so I can zoom in to see the details of the dress? Which essentially meant that they were then able to send me high resolution images, which I could then print out and represent. And what happened in that collection, there's 202 images altogether. And the images are photo after photo after photo of these otherwise glorious moments of the wedding day. You know, the moment that depicts everlasting happiness. But by the face being masked, your emphasis shifts and you start to observe different things in the photos, such as, you know, hunched shoulders represent something quite sad, or an image where the husband and wife and the man is carrying a suitcase and you think, where is he going? Why is he carrying this old fashioned suitcase? And you start to get this real typology of the wedding day, because if you want to be happy forever, you have to be on a beach. I mean, there's so many images of beaches in this collection. And you know, some images are really aggressive. And I began to realize that.
Aggressive how?
Just, you know, really scratched, like a scratched photograph. And I then wanted to, you know, really think about this idea of the performance, where the women were buying these dresses that maybe they couldn't afford, so they could perform this ritual of the wedding day. And after the day, this dress became like a prop. After they'd shared it on Facebook, shared this perfect day, they could then, you know, they would then discard the dress and try and reclaim that money. And so I really wanted to know, to go one step further and think, okay, how, why are they selling their dress? And, you know, certain questions about this, the elements of marriage came through. And I asked them, call me superstitious, but just before I come and buy the dress, can you tell me why you're selling it? And I got kind of sentences from all of them of why they were selling their dress. And certain things became clear, such as debt was a massive reason of why they were then selling their dress.
Wow.
Also the idea of them being too fat. A lot of women talked about being too fat or being too chubby now. And the work really becomes a collection of those reasons. And essentially, for me, this pressure that is put on women, the pressure that's been put on to have that perfect day, to spend more money than you have, to perform this ritual of the wedding day. And the work was all made around a very particular time in the UK, which was 2011 to 2013. And this was a time when Kate and Will were getting married. So they were, you know, in all the newspapers, there were lots of pressure of, you can be a princess too, you can be a princess, you can have the perfect wedding. I suppose much like Disney's been doing in years.
Sure,
for years.
Sure.
But this indoctrination of, you can, you know, you have to spend all this money to be perfect and be pretty. And because of that, there was this shame element of masking the faces and spending too much on their dresses.
Oh, wow.
But the work is open. I mean, the work, some people find it sad, some people find it funny, because they've all, you know, it talks about photography as well, the way that people mask their faces, the way people anonymize their images online. So it ranges from blue tack, from people drawing smiley faces, from an older lady very lovingly folding up a tissue and laying a tissue on her face. I mean, some are very beautiful and they're very powerful.
And I was struck as well by kind of the critique of the, and that was kind of my read, I suppose, the critique of the pressure on women to have this perfect, you know, the fantasy, which I think starts at a very early age. I'm wondering what the critique, I'm going to go back to the married man. I'm wondering, you know, because I thought the critique, I heard a critique potentially of like patriarchal practices on men, on not being able to talk about their relationships or not with various people and having to step outside of their relationships in kind of somewhat culturally sanctified ways, I imagine. Was there an element of critique in the Married Man Project for you in some way of kind of gender politics?
I suppose there is. There was this, and there was an image actually that came after the Married Man, which I suppose brought together that the politics, which was called the Clandestine Purse. And it's one image, this very lush, beautiful, large image, which is a tableau image, which for me became a monument to the purse that I carried around with me. And also talked about this contractual agreement between the man and the woman and the money, this kind of strange money that exists between those gender politics.
Hmm.
And the fact that, you know, can you buy anything? You know, does a woman become a possession? And that objectification of women, I was thinking quite strongly about. And I wanted to kind of make a comment by making that one image that from the beginning of time, I mean, I would use the reference of Chaucer, so that, you know, an Englishman, old English literature, he talked about, he wouldn't ever say the woman's vagina. In his writing, he would call it the woman's purse as the vagina. And I just thought that is so strange. From the beginning of language, we're talking about women being a purse, and that contractual, that money that exists between the men and women. And for me, that's something that really has to be broken down.
Right.
This element of paying, this element of being able to buy.
Hmm. Did anybody? I was gonna ask you, did any of the women from the Fairy Tale for Sale project come out of the woodwork and approach you during the show? Because I know that as well got some press. And
yeah, I mean, that that work's been shown so many places now, really, you know, very internationally. China, five tour showing around Australia. I mean, many, many countries, but no one's ever got in touch with me.
Wow.
Which seemed, or if you imagine, the work also talks about the idea of authorship. So the work is playing with that idea of possession of photography, because the photographer, it's the photographer's image. Somebody else took that photograph. But then the photographer gave it to the bride or the groom, and the bride and the bride appropriated it and then gave it to me, and right. Then I represented it. So it's gone through three different hands of transitions to then be presented. So it's amazing that not even a photographer has got in touch with me to say, that's my image. Well, or that was my image. But no one's ever been in touch, no.
I find that kind of funny. But I'm also kind of struck that it's been resonating internationally, this project. And I imagine cross-culturally that, you know, they're all identifying with this kind of this theme of the fairy tale for sale.
Yeah, I was quite surprised, actually. I you know, imagined when I made it was a comment on the politics of the wedding day in the UK and the politics of this Kate and Will, this princess bride, you know, the pauper to the princess, all these narratives that were being spun. But it's really has spoken internationally, because I suppose there is the same custom, there is the same merit, there is the same, this agreement between the male and the female, which exists completely internationally.
Right.
I can't think of any country that maybe the roles are different of that.
Right. Now,
future project there.
Yeah. Now I want to move on to, I guess what you were capturing, maybe the end of a relationship when you, and this is in reference to your Love Bomb project, yeah. Where you were kind of, you were developing love potions, and this was, this project was, in your words, informed by sorcery, chemistry, and psychotherapy, and it was a response to the breakup of a relationship. And you were attempting to document staying in love and searching for a love potion, and then photographing and making them in your studio. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, I suppose for me, the love bomb is probably one of the hardest ones to talk about, because it is actually quite a personal project. But I was started making it myself, and then I realized that I'd come across something that maybe I should open out to the audience for them to think about as well, which was, I was in a relationship for, you know, many 5 years. And after a few years, I felt, you know, I didn't feel the same, and I didn't understand why it wasn't working. And everything was great, you know, great friendship. We had this, we had that. And it was a feeling that I had, and I didn't know where it had come from. And I felt a lot of shame in the fact that, why am I not able to love? Why am I not able to keep this relationship going? And I felt really, yeah, I felt really bad about it. And I began to torture myself, I suppose, of, you know, is it my fault? Why can I not make this work? And I realized that every day, everywhere we turn, we are bombarded by this idea of the perfect love. From a very young age, you know, I reference Disney again, but we are bombarded by the fact that you will meet your Prince Charming. You know, you will meet the woman of your dreams. But no one ever talks about, really, the difficulty of keeping a relationship. No one really talks about how hard love actually is, how hard it is day to day to keep a relationship going. And I realized there was a really big, grey area between the idea of what we imagine love to be and this idea between the line between love and hate. Mm. And I was finding that I had started to, you know, go to couples counseling to make things work. And I started, through frustration on the internet, I started to look for potions, started to try and find the answers, you know, as anybody do. You sit there and you Google questions, and, you know, I was Googling How Can I Stay in Love? Or something silly like that.
Right.
Late one night in the studio.
I'm sure you're not the only one.
Yeah. You know, how can you stay in love, or how can you make money? All these questions you throw out there.
Right.
And I started, you know, there was this one particular white witch that was going to give me the answers and give me this love potion tea. And then I started to collect these little ingredients in my notebook, and I started to make them. And I started to make these love potions. But at the same time, I also was feeling very, very self-destructive, because I was feeling like, why isn't it working? And so I wanted to make a physical manifestation of that. I wanted to make kind of the physical idea of that self-destruction, which came in the form of the bombs. So I also collected these bombs, which I suppose are used, you know, the idea of a bomb, a homemade bomb, that idea of persuasion, you know, you could persuade anybody, or it could be a form of self-destruction. And the two sit alongside each other, this idea of the love bomb. So there are love potions and there are love bombs, and they are kind of presented in a very particular way, because I showed the work, or the work came into, you know, its full embodiment after the relationship. And I wanted the work to become a really an archive or a monument to that relationship, of, you know, very much kind of putting it to bed. And the images are very rough and ready, you know, quite handmade, quite raw, but they're presented in these beautiful white boxes, and next to them are the ingredients of what was made in either the bomb or the love potion, and they become like little poems. And the work is presented, there's 9 images that I've shown so far of a series of 24. But at the same time as making those bombs and love potions, I began to notice in the newspaper these tiny little whispers, like whispers of man, such as man found eating lover's heart with a fork.
Oh, wow.
Or wife throws away man's penis. And I realized that the difficulty of love is always just so tiny in newspapers. And I began to collect them. And the work, this collection of kind of the difficulties of love, sit alongside that work. You know, I maybe present it differently each time, but that voice of the newspaper and the voice of the everyday is also in that work, because I found, you know, I found affinity with that, the fact that it wasn't just me that was having that difficulty. It is there, but it's just not something we really talk about.
Right. Why do you think that is? Or what do you think keeps us? And I agree with you, as, you know, the work that I do, that, you know, love and romance is presented in one way, but we're not shown the other side. And I think a lot of your work that we've talked about so far actually really looks at, it really wants to give fair hearing, so to speak, to all sides. But I mean, I'm wondering why that continues to be this idea of avoiding these difficult conversations about how relationships really are.
Yeah, I mean, I've got no idea why that is. I mean, I think that maybe Disney has a lot to answer for, the idea of the fairy tale.
Yeah.
Because it's something that's sold from such a young age. And I'm sure there's a lot of, I mean, there must be some real psychology there, that we need to have those fantasies in order to imagine ourselves, or child development. There's probably some really interesting literature out there, which is, you know, maybe something for me to think about in the future, or for a proper medical profession that knows about that. But there must be, I suppose, in that child development, you have that fantasy, and that's needed to create something in us, rather than thinking about the dark things.
Right.
But should it be part of sex education at school, or the education of being told how difficult it is, or part of an exam of getting older, that you have some sort of life skills or tools that will help us when things become difficult, such as learning to listen, or, you know, learning that it isn't always going to be so fantastic, and that there is always another day.
Yeah, I think in the States we would need to get proper sex education first before we can start talking about.
Oh, do you not have? You don't have that there? No.
Depends on where you're at. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Is that even weird, me saying that?
Well,
that
no. Word? You know, we have a lot of abstinence-only education going on here in the States, and so I don't know if they would have real conversations about what relationships are like. Yeah. So I have to ask, what was your experience like in counseling, in couples counseling?
Yeah, I mean, it was useful. It was useful.
You did find it helpful.
Yeah, I found it helpful, kind of just being able to talk about things first by myself and then talking with the partner. Yeah. And again, it was just such torment because even with that, I just felt like I wasn't myself with that person. And that's essentially what it came down to. Yeah. It was not feeling like you are who you want to be with that person. And when you're about to make a life together, you have to think very carefully, don't you, about can I be who I want to be with this person? But it was helpful to realize that. But in the end, something in me just snapped. I just felt completely exhausted by the process and realized that self-destruction or that magic of love, whatever it is, we don't really know what it is yet, do we? Nobody actually does.
No.
I couldn't bottle it. I couldn't keep it. And then in the end, you only end up destroying yourself, which did happen. You know, I was suddenly having panic attacks and going to hospital, and I'm just not that person.
Wow. Yeah.
And it just starts to gnaw away at you. And luckily we hadn't gone too far down the line. We hadn't, you know, walked down the aisle. We hadn't had children. So I was able to walk away.
Mm. Well, thank you for sharing that. I know that's very close to you. And you did mention the magic of love. And so I'm going to move us right into your most recent project where you were trying to employ science and explore love at first sight in a critical and objective way. You were recently awarded, and this is, you know, wonderful news. You were recently awarded the BMW residency, 2014 BMW residency, where you were allowed to go to France and spend some time working, and you chose the topic of love at first sight to take on in this project. So what did you learn about the magic of love while in France?
Well, the project just suddenly appeared. As you heard from my previous answers, this idea of interrogating love and the fantasy of love is something I do not believe in. But suddenly I was walking into a bar and my eyes met a man across the room, and this man turned out to be Simon, and we completely, both of us, had this electric charge. We had to speak to each other. And, you know, as we are told, this is the feeling of love at first sight. It is not something I believe in, but it's a strange thing that happened that particular night. And then I found myself, within a year, he proposed to me. And he proposed to me and said, I've booked everything and we're getting married in 6.5 weeks. So I was like, great. And I didn't even feel scared. But the week before the wedding, I was suddenly completely terrified. What am I doing? I'm marrying someone because of a feeling. I'm marrying someone I don't know. And my mum was saying, come and get your spray tan, come and get your nails done. And I just wanted to get out. I mean, it was just horrendous. Suddenly this pressure was just living. I was there. I was a bride. I was about to be a bride.
Wow.
And I, in a very, very short amount of time, I mean, if you imagine, people have years to plan these things. And I hadn't thought about it since I was, you know, I didn't really believe in it. And the week before the wedding, as I said, big freak out. And like I always do, I found my kind of calm in the library. So I went to the British Library and I spent a few days there before the wedding, literally camped from morning till night. And I began to look for the answers. I began to research about what is love? Is love at first sight true? You know, what is this chemical reaction that I'm having that's making me walk down the aisle with a stranger but I feel so comfortable with? Why do I feel so comfortable with this person? And because on paper, I mean, divorced, he's got 2 children, you know, isn't somebody I imagine that I'd be with, but it just worked. And I didn't find the answers, but I did marry him. Hmm. And then, as you mentioned, this BMW Artist in Residency Award at Nice for Niepce Museum, it was about leaving for 3 months to go and live in this very small town in the middle of France where Niepce, the inventor of photography, is his museum So it's a very important place. It's the birthplace of photography.
Right.
And I actually packed my bags. I got married on the Sunday, and I packed my bags and I left on the Tuesday. So if you imagine, within 72 hours of walking down the aisle, I then said goodbye to all my friends and family and my husband, and I moved to France by myself. You know, a very unique experience.
Yes.
No honeymoon. I just did it. And when I got there, I realized that actually this is really interesting. I'm going to use this to talk about love at first sight, to try and investigate this phenomenon of love at first sight, of whether it's real or not, if other people had experienced it, and this idea of looking at it and at an objective point of view, critically looking at it. And that came through looking at the science behind love at first sight. And I kind of narrowed it down to 7 key experiments where science has tried to find the answers. And with that research, the science really started. I mean, love wasn't actually investigated since the first experiment was 1974.
Really?
Before that, they thought love was just an extension of liking somebody a lot. And I remade experiments about love, such as, how do two people match and pair with each other? What questions can you ask each other to create intimacy? One experiment was in a pole dancing club. These scientists had every night, the dancers did the same dance. They wore the same outfit. They did the same duration. And every night they collected their tips of how many tips they earned that night. What do the men give them in tips?
Wow.
And also they tested their estrogen in their saliva. And they found that the 3 days that those women were most fertile, so the 3 days just as the egg was dropping, their tips actually spiked. So the men in the room, they found those women more attractive. They didn't know that they were the most fertile. The pheromones, they could sense it. This kind of animalistic mating and desire came across, and completely fascinating. So I used science, and then I also spoke to people that had experienced love at first sight and kind of documented their stories, and we recreated the images. And I suppose it is the most photographic series that I've shot, where I actually used film camera, I used flash, like the lightning bolt that hit people in that moment. And I kind of worked with them. I interviewed all the subjects that I found. If you imagine, I knew nobody. I knew no French. I had to learn all of this.
Right.
And
were you able to find several people that spoke of love at first sight?
Yeah, I definitely found. I mean, it wasn't everybody. It wasn't by any means everybody. But the people that experienced it, they absolutely experienced it. They were, for them, that was it. They met them. And in some happenings, maybe it wasn't returned. Maybe it was just the man that felt it or the woman that felt it.
Hmm.
It wasn't that it was always just the two people. And again, I was very open. So, one man said, well, sure, I experience it every day. So that, I kind of used a range of stories because nobody knows what it is at all. But by the end of the project, the work is essentially, it's a conversation between the science and people's feelings, people's own histories. And the work presents a question to the audience of whether it exists or not. And I feel that it isn't resolved. It's the magic of love at first sight is still there. I didn't find the resolution of it in the end, which I think, again, is quite beautiful that it's left open for the audience and what their own experiences are of this phenomenon. And the fact that, those months ago, I had this challenge of how do you photograph something that's completely unphotographable?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you even begin to photograph love at first sight? And I loved that challenge at the beginning, and the fact that it's such a cliche. Why would anybody win, such a great award, be working in such an important place as Musée Nieppes with a great team to support me and want to photograph love at first sight? I mean, it sounds like madness, but I love that challenge.
Yeah. And how was the response to the project?
Yeah, the project's gone really well. Yeah, I mean, I showed it. It's on now in France, in the south of France, at a festival called Recontre d'Arles. And I suppose the reference for you would be Cannes is just kind of along the river, or along the Med slightly.
Right.
So like Cannes is for the film industry, Arles is like for the photography industry where this festival is. So it's really important.
Wow.
You know, I've been there, you know, I've just come back from there, and you know, there's flowers in my room and VIP packs and so much champagne. It was just such an amazing experience to have my work, you know, kind of shown there.
That's great.
And then it's also just opened in, it's a billboard show. So a large billboard show in the metro in Paris at the moment, and a group show. And it's also in London at the moment as part of the work of my new residency in an exhibition called Love is an Act, which is on in London at the moment.
Right. Do you think it'll travel?
Yeah, I hope. Yeah, I imagine. I hope it will travel.
Hmm.
You have to sort something out for me, Chris.
Yes. We need to do something here in California.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice project. It brings together data and statistics, you know, the data of love. Can you learn about love through numbers and graphs? It also, I use concrete. So I made these concrete hearts.
Hmm.
And the photography, I've got a plasma ball in there.
Why concrete? And,
yeah, concrete. I made concrete and printed on top of concrete.
Was there a reason for the concrete?
Yeah, because I was I wanted this. The work on it is an anatomical drawing. So the anatomical drawings kind of narrate or punctuate the love and the science and the people's feelings. And the heart, it's basically a heart beating. So it's 1, 2, 3. And on these three stones is that duration of time, beating 1, 2, and 3.
Hmm.
And the heart, I became fascinated. The heart is how we imagine love. But of course, the heart is not the heart. The heart is a machine.
Right.
It's the mind. But we have so many narratives, such as cold-hearted, heart of stone. And we really connect this. I wanted to actually make these heart of stones to kind of think about the idea of it not being the heart at all. But we have so much emphasis on it being this heart. I mean, it's absolutely everywhere.
It's true.
But it's the mind that creates it, and chemicals in the mind.
Hmm. Well, wonderful. So you do have a current show up in London now?
Yeah, I've got a current show in London at the ODI. And the ODI is called the Open Data Institute. And this is a new residency which started 2 weeks ago now. And I'm working with this organization for 6 months. And the organization is set up by Tim Berners-Lee. So the man that created the internet is kind of who I'm working with now, which
wow.
is amazing.
Yeah.
To be kind of the way that they have this amazing foresight that artists kind of see things before other people do. So they've got this great data as culture program. So I'm embedded in them with them for 6 months to think about a proposal. And then I have maybe 8 months to make this new body of work, which brings together the ideas of the internet and the everyday and open data. You know, what does open data mean? The way that we are using, we're collecting data all the time. Every time we use our Visa card, every time we're traveling, every time we buy drugs from a pharmacy, every time the police come to a road accident, they write, you know, there's a table that's created. Mm. How many people, what road it was, what happened, everything is numerized. And what does it mean that that is all being collated every day? And the internet is doing that. So I'm there to help think about what would happen if everything's open. What would happen if Google didn't actually keep those statistics on us and put them out there? So other developers like City Mapper. Do you have City Mapper in LA?
No.
You know, apps where you can get around.
We use Google Maps mostly, I think.
Yeah, well, there's so many different apps that are just able to empower people day to day by they tap into these open sources. So it's a whole new, it's just going to be absolutely massive. It's only been running 2 years. And it's a real new way of thinking about the future of the internet and the future of the web and how we communicate this network lives.
There's one here in LA, and I'm thinking it's called Wave, where it tracks It's an open data app where it tracks everybody's flow in the traffic, so you can see where the traffic jams are and that kind of thing. I'm forgetting the name of the app. I think it's like Wave or something like that. But
yeah, so that is only, that can only happen because the people that run the highway are actually putting that those data sets out as open. So data sets become, it has to be anonymized, it has to be, you can't make money from it, and it has to be cleaned up. And then once it's done that, those three sources, those three elements, you can then, other people can tap into it. And it means we can get to work quicker, we know where the jams are. You know, if you're disabled, you're able to know, you know, how many steps there are from the metro, or you could find out if you live in a particular county, whether you're going to, or a particular state, whether you can get certain drugs or not. And yeah, it's really, it's quite difficult for me to talk about even at the moment because it is so new for me. Right. Because I've always used the internet, as you've heard, you know, I've always used this kind of network life or network bring into the everyday. So to suddenly be approached and say, look what you've been doing, now let's make a body of work together on something that is very, there's very particular terms. I've been using them kind of very rudimentary, kind of very basic.
Right.
And suddenly there's a whole vocabulary there that I'm trying to learn because other people have been doing this at the same time.
So you're feeling good about this challenge, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah, I am. I am feeling good, particularly because I think a lot of artists so far have made work which is quite heavy in terms of the military or drones or warfare. They've approached me to say, you know, you can make something really everyday. You can make something that people can connect to about this idea of open data. You know, you've been doing it anyway. So, yeah, it does. I've just been there today. It's amazing. You're sitting in the office and maybe it's a bit like I imagine Google will be. You know, we all stand up at 10 o'clock around a circle and we say, what are our aims of today? What are our goals? And we have group lunches together. There's bean bags. There's little closed areas. And it's all very cool.
Yeah. Wow.
And it's in Tech City. It's right in the middle of Tech City.
Mm.
So, but they're, it's very important that they're there because they're advising the government. They're advising big corporates about, you know, why should you be holding that information on people? What would happen if you opened it up? And then really informing people about that.
Wow. Well, I'm excited to see what comes out of this project. And I just want to say, Natasha, thank you for spending some time with me today and actually the first episode of The Radical Therapist.
I can't believe it.
I know.
Can't believe it. You never told me that. I'm completely honored, Chris.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
I think it's kind of special. And I thought you would be the perfect guest just because, and obviously in the conversation we had, just how the work you do and what you're doing, it was just wonderful for you to take some time and share it. And so if our listeners are interested in tracking your work and finding out what you're up to, how do they do that?
They can do that through my website, which is, I suppose, you can see the bodies of work on that.
Great.
I also keep a news page on there. And I run a Facebook, which is NatashaCaruana/artist. That's where I keep things up to date and you can have a chat with me on there.
Okay.
A lot of people contact me via there and talk about some of their own problems or what they're thinking about. And that's become quite a nice, and it, you know, it's completely private. So some nice conversations have come through on there, or you can just see it's quite a diary. Or I'm on Instagram as well, _NatashaCaruana.
Yep.
And Twitter, at NatashaCaruana. So I'm quite on social media, so it's not hard to find me.
And I'll provide links for all of that on both the website and our podcast site and so they can access you. And once again, Natasha, thank you very much for taking the time out. I love chatting with you. I hope to run into you in Paris again sometime soon or even London and give my best to Simon when you see him.
Yes.
And I'm sure we'll talk with you soon enough.
Great. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks, Natasha.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the first episode of The Radical Therapist. We hope you come back for more. Please subscribe to our podcast either at iTunes or at Podbean. Also, if you're interested in seeing more of Natasha's work, I will throw some links up on our website at theradicaltherapist.com and also on our Podbean site at The Radical Therapist. And you'll be able to access some of the images that were talked about during the show. I think it's well worth your time, and you can get a better idea of kind of some of the stuff that we were talking about. Please, if you have any questions or comments about the show, please send me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. We're also on Instagram at The Radical Therapist. We're on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter under The Rad Therapist. Please follow us, find us, create dialogue with us. Just let us know how we're doing and what we can be doing better. Anyway, before I take off, I want to say a real give a very special thanks to Jesse Dollimore and Brittany Page, who without their help, this project wouldn't have got off the ground. They are both co-hosts of the wonderful news podcast. and they'll probably think I'm being too respectable, but they're a wonderful news podcast. I Doubt It with Dollimore. Please seek it out. Subscribe to it. Give it a listen. They do a great job. It's where I get most of my news now. It's worth your time. So thank you for your listen, and please keep coming back. Thanks.